This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
To Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, a podcast presentation of Cadence 13 in association with Black Barrel Media and Ritual Productions. This is an episode-by-episode look at the award-winning TV show Friday Night Lights, created by Peter Berg. I'm Stacey Orestano. I play Mindy Collette Riggins.
And I'm Derek Phillips, and I play Billy Riggins.
Our assumption is that you, our listeners, have already watched the show.
But if you haven't already, go watch Friday Night Lights, which is currently streaming on Netflix and Peacock TV, because there will be spoilers in our podcast.
Hey, guys, we got merch.
That's right, baby. So go check out our brand new website at ClearEyesFullHeartsPod.com. That's ClearEyesFullHeartsPod.com.
Also, every few weeks, we'll do an audience participation episode just to answer your questions. So email us what you want to know at ClearEyesFullHeartsPod@gmail.com. Today, we're talking about Season 1, Episode 9, Full Hearts. It was written by Aaron Rossin Thomas and directed by Josh Pate. Here's our NBC synopsis. Lila and Tim are alienated as rumors about their relationship spread. Smash puts his health at risk in an attempt to improve his performance on the field. Julie and Matt go on their first date, and the Panthers face the intimidating Gatling High team.
We also have another guest with us today, and this is a big one. Brian Smash Williams is here. We're going to talk to Gaius Charles, who played Smash, later in this episode, and you're going to love his story. So let's get to our highlights from this episode before we go behind the scenes with Gaius Charles.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's Sunday in Dillon, Texas, and we're baking muffins and we're doing steroids. Huh?
Wait, all of us. We're all doing steroids and baking muffins.
Well, no, Smash is doing the steroids, but Lila's baking the muffins. And then Slamming Sammy Mead comes on. He's got some stuff to say about what's going on in town.
Ooh, the whole town has some stuff to say about what's going on.
That was
a lot.
It was. And I didn't quite realize how racist it was until I kind of heard it again. You know, these guys are like, you know how those folks over in Gatlin are. And we do know after this episode that the majority of Gatlin is African-American. The folks at Dillon don't take too kindly to that.
And also, we learn Smash is from there. So that's his hometown. And his childhood rival is on the team.
This is correct. His childhood rival, Junior Silvero.
Sounds intimidating.
Oh, it's Junior Silverio. I apologize. Yes, and he is intimidating. When you see him later in the episode, you'll realize this is a gigantic man.
Just going to hit some highlights about this before we get in with Gaius. Some of my favorite moments. Coach and Tammy are talking about Julie going on a date, and Coach says, at least she's not into Riggins. And which, like, you know what? Yeah.
Hey, that's not a very nice thing to say. Because when he says, I think he says, at least she's not dating one of the Riggins, plural.
Oh, like, so it's both of you.
It could have been me or Tim, which is an insult to me and Tim. It's rude. Thanks, Coach.
If you had a daughter like Julie, would you want her dating Tim?
Of course not.
No, there you go.
And I definitely wouldn't want her dating Billy.
I do end up dating Billy.
Yeah, but at least you're of age.
Julie's like, all around.
What, 16 here? That would have been really weird and creepy. Ugh.
I do have to say, I think the highlight of this episode, the one through line that goes all the way through it, is this members only jacket.
Yes, I think the standout in this episode, by and large, is the members only jacket, how it plays, and the fact that it's brought back so many different times. It is definitely one of my favorite parts of this episode. There's a lot of good stuff in this episode. So
a good, solid Landry-Matt scene is my favorite. And them at shopping at the vintage store is up there in the top of my favorites.
Yeah, those two guys together are literally like just the comic stylings of Landry and Matt. Once again, at the vintage store, they crush it every single time. Always fun to watch those two. And then we go back to the high school and we realize that word is kind of there's a lot of rumors spreading throughout Dylan that something went down with Street and Tim. And on top of it, everyone's starting to find out that there may have been some infidelity, as it were, between Tim and Lila.
I'm guessing this stems from the punch from Street to Tim. And then that starts to spread.
Well, yeah, and then there's
school,
rumors.
The high school rumor spreads.
Yeah, why would Street punch Tim? These guys are best friends. The only thing it could possibly be is, and a little knitting circle starts putting two and two together, basically. The football knitting circle.
To be fair, it really is kind of the only thing that would make Street punch Tim at this point in time. So, like, listen, they're not wrong in their rumors and what they're talking about.
Even Coach at this point knows that something's up. He pulled Matt Saracen aside and has a little conversation with him. And before he even pulls him aside, he goes, "Hey, how you doing, Lance?" Which is one of my favorite things on the planet. I'm pretty sure Kyle improv that. He always calls Landry Lance.
It's going to last the whole show.
Yeah, I think towards the end, maybe in season 5, he starts to remember his name. But I think it's just a brilliant little touch by Kyle Chandler to constantly call him Lance. I love it. It's just one of the many things on this show that just, it's like, yeah, that's perfect. He nails it. Why would he know this kid's name?
I love learning a little bit more about the backstories of these characters. And we are starting to hear a bit more about Smash's family at the dinner table and them going to Gatlin. There's a barbecue that they're going to go to and their friends are there. And then Smash, just out of nowhere, comes up with this line: "Did you want us out of Gatlin or away from Dad?"
Yeah.
And that is such a loaded question. And it makes me, I have like 80 questions spinning off of that question.
Yeah. And you can see, I mean, the wheels turning in Liz Michael's head when he says that. It's like, you better watch it.
Oh, I think he does have to leave the table.
Yeah. Up until this point, we haven't really had much conversation on the show about what happened to Smash's father. I know that there's a mention of it in the pilot that his father passed away, but Smash immediately says, "I don't want to talk about that." So we really don't know where Dad is. And we're going to find out what happened to him in this episode.
Speaking of members only jackets.
Oh, yes. This is
Matt comes into the house to pick up Julie. Coach, of course, asks, "Is that a members only jacket?"
I mean, Kyle Chandler in this scene, I mean, he really is. He's like a Henny Youngman. He's just crushing him with one-liners. Every 5 seconds, he's got a one-liner for him. And then, meanwhile, this is another beautiful moment. Julie comes walking down the hall. She looks gorgeous. And Coach immediately goes, And he sees her outfit. He's like, "That's enough. No, go change." Matt can't take his eyes off Julie the whole entire time. Coach is trying to have a conversation with him. It's really, I mean, it's the comic timing between everyone in this scene. It's just totally on point. And then Coach says, "Why don't you take your members only jacket off and hang it on the coat rack?" And he goes, "What?" He goes, "Hang up your jacket." Hangs up his jacket. And he goes, "You want a beer?" "No, I'm driving," says Matt. I mean, it's Kyle Chandler just nailing one-liners one after the other with this kid.
If I was 16 and I came out dressed up and I felt really pretty, and then my parents were like, "No," and they made me change, and like my date saw that happen, I would be mortified.
I agree, but she is dressed a little provocatively for a... How old is Julie? Have we established? I think she's 15, 16 years old. I know that she's driven in this episode.
Yeah, I'm gonna
or it's
say
established
16.
That she has. Yeah, but I know in a later episode, they're teaching her how to drive. So I think we got to assume that despite... Look, we got to be careful with any kind of age continuity on Friday Night Lights. That's something that you just kind of have to accept going into it, as we've discussed before. But I mean, look, he's trying to protect his daughter. She was dressed a little provocatively, and he's like, no, you're not wearing
I'm not saying they're wrong. I just, in the place of being a teenage girl, be mortified. Those heels were way too high to wear to a movie theater. I will say that right now. That is unnecessary. You're going to a movie.
This whole entire scene it's because we've all been through it. I had one when I was in high school. I went to pick a girl up, and her father came outside, and he goes, "Those tires look pretty bald." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "You're going to be driving my daughter around in that car and your tires look pretty bald." And I'm like, okay. And he's like, "Just be careful." And I'm like, "Yes, sir." And I'm backing up and I gave him a little wave and I ran into his mailbox. Yeah. I mean, it was so embarrassing. Just right along the side of the passenger side of the car.
Oh, no.
Knocked it over. And I'm like, I'll come back and fix that. Sorry, sir. His daughter's in the car next to me, just like, "What's wrong with you?" And yeah, obviously. That date didn't go well.
Oh,
and speaking of dates that didn't go well, this date is like a date from hell.
Disaster from the get-go.
Yeah.
He wants to get into this movie, just assumes that when he gets there, they'll have a ticket for him because he's QB1. Like, that in of itself is mortifying. The members only jacket is mortifying. The changing of the clothes is mortifying. And then,
and remember, now he's trying to act like he's somebody that he's not. You know what I mean? He says, one of my people recommended it. He's trying to, Landry, I love him to death, but he gives the worst advice on the planet when it comes to dating. Number one, he stuck him in this members only jacket. And he's constantly saying, look, man, no one's going to like you for who you are. So you got to try to be somebody different. And the reality is, that's not true.
Right. So he said Julie's not going out with Matt Saracen. She's going out with QB1. And Julie's telling her friend, no, he's not a football player. He's just Matt Saracen. And it's like, oh, you two like each other. Just be sweet.
Yeah, just be yourselves. Just be yourselves.
Be yourselves. It gets better. And then there's, I guess, Landry, this is just some smartness on his part, got Julie's phone number, called Julie's cell phone. I'm guessing Matt doesn't have a cell phone. I don't know. Called Julie. Julie's like, it's your person on the phone. Landry's freaking out. They have to go back to the house because something is wrong with Grandma Saracen. Yeah. That's all we have gathered so far.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, poor Matt. He's just trying to have a date with the girl he loves. And it's like everything comes falling apart. And now Julie's going to have to see the one thing that he's embarrassed about, which is the fact that he's got no money, the fact that his grandmother's sick. He doesn't want anyone to know this about him. And he's been putting on this front that he's stud quarterback number one and QB1. And now, unfortunately, she's going to have to see the other side of Matt Saracen, which he's mortified about.
And I do. It is a little sweet that Landry was sort of, babysitting is a terrible word for this, but watching Grandma Saracen while they were on their date, but something must have gone very wrong. Grandma Saracen has locked herself in the closet. I will tell you, I have seen this episode before. I remember specifically sitting at Annie's place in Austin when it came out, and we were sobbing at that scene. And then we spent 30 minutes talking about how much we loved Liz Michael. But this scene specifically has stayed in my mind for 15 years now.
Yeah, it's one of those scenes on Friday Night Lights that just resonates, and they just nail it. I mean, from the acting to the editing to the sound to everything.
God, just her in the closet. She's so, so scared.
Yeah.
Matt knows exactly what to do. He's so sweet. He pretends to be grandpa, and then he sings her their song and puts her to bed. Oh, God, it's so sweet.
Another thing that struck me in rewatching this was the expression that Landry has on his face. He's literally scared to death at this situation. He's never seen anything like this, and I think he's realizing for the first time what Matt actually has to go through. But he's got tears in his eyes watching it because it's a lot for a kid to take in. You know, I think sometimes we forget that these are just high school kids. And the expression on Jesse Plemons' face, who plays Landry, is just like, it guts you. Even Julie, when she's explaining the next day what happened on her date with her mom, I think they realize how lucky they are that their lives are a little bit more simple than Matt's are. No, it puts things in perspective, I think.
And then just in the same token of them never being on the same page, and Matt thinks, the date is a disaster. She saw me sing to my grandmother. That's so embarrassing. And Julie's like, wait, I saw this whole other side to Matt Saracen, and he's really very sweet. And again, I just want to smush their faces together so they kiss and get over it.
And of course, Landry says the same thing. He's like, that may be the only thing that saved you, you know?
To be fair.
Yeah, and it's true.
Thanks, Grandma. Well,
but he was being himself. And that, at the end of the day, is what saved him, is the fact that, like, he wasn't trying to put on some air or trying to pretend to be the superstar quarterback. He was just being Matt Saracen. And we love Matt Saracen. All of us.
We do. And then he and Landry talking about it I think it's in the cafeteria the next day. And Landry says, there's no reason to blame the coach or just because you couldn't pull it off.
Brilliant line.
He's dead set on that members only jacket.
It's a brilliant line.
Then find out, this hit me in a way that I had completely forgotten about. The nickname Smash, which, by the way, Brian has told us before that he gave himself, actually comes from his dad when he crashed his bike into a wall.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong in this, originally the character's name was Crash. Or maybe I know when we were doing the pilot, I said Crash, and Pete goes, no, his name is Smash now. Or maybe he just said, maybe I just misread it, but I thought that it was Crash Williams.
So he's working out with his sister, Sheila, played by Whitney McCulley, who I have always loved. She's so, so good in this.
Yeah, she's
great. You can tell she knows something's up with her brother, and she's asking very pointed and very specific questions about, like, did your skin break out before and stuff. She she knows things.
She knows something's up, and she knows he's up to no good.
They just go to the doctor, check him out. He's fine, and doctor is the same as everybody else in Adele, and that's like, please crush them when you play Scotland this weekend.
Yeah, the whole town revolves around football. We know this, obviously. Speaking of up to no good, the next scene that we have, or one of the next scenes that we have, is Tim pulls up into the driveway, and who should be there but a host of angry Dylan Panthers.
Angry Dylan Panthers with baseball bats. I definitely thought they were going to pull him out of the truck and beat him up.
I did too when I first watched that scene. But yeah, I mean, it's basically these guys, they know at this point that Tim and Lila were having a little fling, and they're none too happy about it. He got offensive linemen basically protecting their quarterback, which is what happens.
Do you know what? I guess it's on and smart on a couple of reasons, because that truck is his baby and they hurt the thing that would hurt him the most. And they also can't hurt one of their star players because they need him for the game. So listen, good on you guys. That was like, now that I think about it, that was some smart baseball thinking.
Yeah, but it doesn't bode well. I mean, you got a major game against Gatlin coming up and the team is kind of divided now. Well, not divided. I guess everyone's.
I mean, they all want to win.
The fact that they're pissed off at Tim.
This game, the girls in the stands start yelling at Lila, and they're throwing things at her while she's cheering. And she's finally had enough, and she runs under the bleachers. Buddy gets up and leaves the game and goes down to take care of his daughter. He says to her, "It's only a game." That was like Brad Leland. Knocking it out of the park there.
Totally. It goes back to the thing that we've said over and over and over again already on this podcast, which is the fact that this is a show where we have three-dimensional characters. Up until this point, all we've seen of Buddy Garrity is that Buddy Garrity is the booster. He's the car dealership guy. He wants to win. He'll win at any cost. And now you see that there's another side to this guy. And the reality is he loves his daughter. And he loves his daughter more than football. And up until this point, I don't know that we could have said that we believe that.
I would
that
not
was
have
true.
Said that until that moment.
No. I mean, he left a game. And she even says that. He left the game. And he goes, "It's only a game. You're my daughter."
Ugh.
It's a beautiful scene. Played brilliantly by both Minka and Brad Leland.
So sweet.
Yeah. I had a conversation with Brad Leland the other day. And he was listening to our podcast. And he said he did not think that my buddy Garrity was on point. And that was, he was listening to the first episode of the podcast. So
it has gotten better since episode one, though.
He goes, "Hey, man, I got a problem. I got a problem with your buddy Garrity." He goes, "It used to be good, Derek, but right now it does not sound like me. That's not what I sound like."
It's back, though.
And I don't know, guys, I think, is it back, Stacey? Okay.
You just needed to watch a couple episodes is the thing.
It comes and goes. I need to talk to Brad more. Poor Brad.
It only comes from love.
I need to call him and just listen to his voice. He's like, "Hey, man, why are you calling me? What's going on? What's new with you? Oh, what's new? Nothing, Brad. I just wanted to hear your voice so I can do my impression."
You know, your face changes when you do it too, right? It's a quizzical, the eyes squint. There's a quizzical in the face.
Brad and I actually had a conversation because Brad is great at doing Texas impressions, basically. Oh, like Brad can do like every reason.
And then he tells you the reason why they all sound the way they do. Exactly. It's like a fascinating monologue.
He said, like in West Texas, they got to talk like this with their mouth closed because there's dirt flying through the air and it'll hit you. You know, and I can't do regional Texas dialects the way that Brad can, but he can go through every regional Texas dialect. And he just nails it. Next time we have him on the show, we'll have to ask him to do
that. I was thinking about that the other
day. But enough with Buddy Garrity, Brad Leland.
Moving on, I do have to tell you, the game, the fact that they gave Smash the winning TD, like they're winning the game, I got goosebumps. I was excited for the team. I cheered for football.
Especially after the last time we saw Smash play, I think, was the homecoming game where he did not have a good game. So to see him performing, even though it's performing really well because he's on steroids, is great. Nonetheless, he's still on steroids and that might be he's doing so well. But another cool thing that happened in this episode, I thought, is that, yes, Smash does score the winning touchdown, but Riggins throws the lead block on Junior Silverio, the talented Gatling
the giant
linebacker. And he does this after he's been injured. And because of the fact that he came back into the game after his injury, the team forgives him. It's like it's like all water under the bridge. But we'll see in the next episode that it's not going to work that smoothly for Lila. And that episode is called It's Different for Girls.
Because I thought, it's different for girls.
Yeah, it is different for girls, 100%. Riggins is forgiven. They beat the crap out of his car and it's over with. I think women have a tendency to deal with that kind of stuff a little bit differently. And we're going to see it in the next episode. I mean, it's
Are you saying that maybe
awful.
Instead we should just get baseball bats and go beat up cars?
Well, frankly, if I had the option of, do I want to be tortured in high school every single day for the rest of the year, or somebody come over and beat the crap out of my car and it's over 24 hours later, I'll take the baseball bat to the car any day
I'm
of the week.
I'm with you.
I mean, this next episode is really, really hard to watch.
I haven't seen it. Now I'm all going to get remembrance of Mean Girls in high school. I'm just saying, I was shocked at myself for being as invested in the football game as I was. I got goosebumps. And a lot of it has to do with the gorgeous music they always put under the scoring of it. But, and then he runs up and like, he doesn't even need to celebrate with his team. He runs up in the stands and just finds his mom. And he's like, let's go home.
And you know who else finds somebody? Matt Saracen finds Julie and they have their first kiss.
So cute and so sweet.
This is a good episode. Solid episode all the way around.
That made me very happy.
And we learn a ton about Smash. And we've got our special guest, Gaius Charles, up right now. And we're going to learn even more about Smash. So please stick around, guys. It's going to be interesting.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, we're back with the multi-talented Gaius Charles, who plays Brian Smash Williams. Our listeners will also know Gaius from his television roles on such shows as Taken, God Friended Me, NCIS, Drunk History, Roswell, New Mexico, Aquarius, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Blind Spot, Law & Order SVU, Necessary Roughness, and of course as Dr. Shane Ross on the groundbreaking and iconic ABC drama Grey's Anatomy. Gaius has also starred in multiple films, including Salt opposite Angelina Jolie and the Academy Award-winning film The Messenger, starring Ben Foster and Woody Harrelson. Gaius, welcome to the show, man. Thank you so much for being here. We are excited to have
What's
you.
What's up, man? Great to be here. That intro, I was kind of feeling myself for a second with that intro.
I almost had to take a sip of water there because there's a few Thanks, credits.
Man. So tell us about how Friday Night Lights happened for you, fell into your lap.
Well, it's a long story. There's a whole testimony behind it. But I was just auditioning for a bunch of stuff. I just graduated from college and I was auditioning for a bunch of stuff in New York.
Can I jump in real quick and tell the audience where you went to school?
It is very special.
Because I think this is kind of important. Like, Gaius graduated from Carnegie Mellon, which for those of you who don't know, is literally like one of the top five theater programs in the country every single year for undergraduate theater programs. So just to give you a little reference as to Gaius's
Appreciate
background.
You, man. Yeah, so I was doing the hustle. Y'all know the hustle. Yep. When you graduate school, you're auditioning, you're in New York, you're in LA, and I get this script and this email like, yeah, the show Friday Night Lights and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, football show, didn't really play football. All right, I'll give it a crack. And long story short, I just felt like this was for me, and I went. Because this is back in the day. See, I don't even know how they do it now. But back in the day, they used to like bring in their top pick from New York and then their LA people. And they'd fly the New York pick out to LA to audition everybody, to test with everybody. And I remember before leaving for New York, I just felt like really like God was saying this was my role, this was the role he had for me. And I just went forward with that faith, auditioned. And within like 3 days, headed to Austin to work on this show called Friday Night Lights.
Holy, that's so fast.
Yeah, were you in New York when you auditioned or LA when you auditioned?
I was in New York when I taped. So I went to 30 Rock, taped at 30 Rock. And then, it's funny because when I taped, and it's the whole game of doing, and back then it was a tape just with the casting director in the room. And I remember, I don't know why I said this, but I remember like saying like, hey, Pete, you looking for me, baby. You looking for me, Pete.
Stop like, it.
And I remember he said to me later, he was like, because they, when you're the execs and the producers, they're just watching tape all day, yeah. And so I remember he said, when he heard that, he looked up and like actually like really watched my tape. And that was one of the things that helped push it forward. So Yeah,
I
crazy.
Is this true? Did you have to go to the emergency room like right before your audition?
I did. So I was like getting into football mode because I was like, all right, you know, play. I did track in school. I didn't do play football. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go running. I'm gonna go lift some weights, whatever. And like the night before, I went running and just kind of tweaked my ankle. And I was like, dang. And so they rescheduled it and everything. And, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, but it was just like, it was one of those things that just kind of helped me take it serious. Like maybe there's something to this thing. Cause it seems like there's some things that are just pointing to me taking this seriously. And so I did. And the show happened.
I love that. It's like the world sort of tells you to slow down and you can like really study your sides and think about what you're going to do.
Exactly. Cause when you're auditioning right out of school, you're literally getting, it's funny. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, but you're literally getting like 5 and 6 auditions sometimes. You know, this is back in the day, pre-pandemic, obviously, but where you would literally like, you would go to New York and you'd have like 4 or 5 auditions in one day. So you'd get on the bus or the train at like 7 a.m., 8 a.m., and you'd be in the city all day running around town.
Changing clothes in bathrooms.
Changing clothes. That hustle, you know, that New York hustle. And then sometimes it's like you're getting emails, or this was like really actually before even real big smartphones. So you're getting a call like, hey, just go to this office. They got the side, just the hustle of it. And yeah, that's what I came up in. And that's one of the things that helped, like I said, accelerate.
I remember when I was living in New York, it was like 98 when I first got out there and I got a cell phone. And I was one of the first people I knew that wasn't like a doctor or a drug dealer that had a cell phone.
Right.
And everybody thought, they're like, what are you, a drug dealer? And I'm like, no, man, I'm an actor. Yeah. And they're like, why don't you just have a call service.
Right.
When I started in this business, you had to like literally walk over to a payphone.
Oh, yeah, because you had a pager.
And call a service and give you messages.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
That's how old school I am. Yes. I also had fax machines.
Yeah.
And like when you wanted to read a script, you had to go to your agent's office to actually check the script out because there wasn't, they weren't emailing scripts.
I don't remember the fax, but I remember like if you wanted a script, like you would get a FedEx package like the next day.
Wasn't that amazing? Sometimes you would just like open your door and you'd have a script there and it would
like a stack of FedEx package. Like what is,
And the new, guys, for our listeners, every time they like rewrite a script, they change it to a new color. So it's like, here's your blue script, here's your goldenrod script or whatever it is. And you're like, ooh, a new color script just arrived at my door.
Goldenrod's the only color I ever remember. I don't know why.
Because it sounds so fancy. Okay, so what did you know about Brian going into the pilot?
I didn't really know a lot because, you know, the process of doing the pilot is really to get those like kind of broad brush strokes, you know. And I just remember like one of the things I look back at and I just go, wow, is how collaborative the experience was, especially after spending some time in the business and just kind of seeing how the experience is often not like that, you know, when you're starting out and just getting going. And for people to just be welcoming of you ad-libbing and bringing in new ideas and just really owning your character and directing your character and off, like, you know, I would send an email to Jason Tatum's about something and like, you would actually see he integrated or incorporated what you were talking about in that conversation in the next script or in the current script. It was just unbelievable, you know, and then to be doing that at like 22, 23, again, it's like, who are these guys? Like they're really owning the show. They're owning these characters. And that was one of the reasons why we could do that.
It was just a total lack of ego. It felt like for everybody involved, everyone put their egos.
So much faith and trust put in you guys, especially the ones that were playing the high school kids. It's a lot of faith and trust to put in people. But again, a testament to Pete Berg and Linda Lowy and everyone who cast this show that you guys just mesh and fit and everything just works. Sure.
What was your initial take on the pilot when you read it?
That's a good question. It's funny because I remember people saying like, this is going to be really big. This is going to be, and I was just like, okay, cool. You know, I was like, it's just, okay, great. But as a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, like just getting out of school, you're just along for the ride. Like you don't really know what you're just learning what you're doing. You're just learning how this business works. I remember
like on paper, I didn't think the script was like spectacular. You know what I mean? But I do remember like, I love the movie first and foremost. And I love the book Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
But I remember like getting the script and being like, oh, it's basically just kind of the movie with some different named characters.
Mm.
And then, so my next question was gonna be like, okay, so there was that process. Then there was the actual shooting process where I was like, okay, wait a minute. This is different. Like some of the stuff that like some of the dialogue that may have been a little stilted on paper suddenly like jumped off the page when you got in there and started working on it because Pete allows us to improv stuff.
Yeah, and shoots and shoots things at you in the moment.
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, like to your point, that's what kind of kept us so organic and authentic. And not having to worry so much about hitting this mark or doing it this way, or even sometimes having to match continuity, like all that kind of stuff. And like, those just weren't big issues. It was just like, just live in this world, breathe these characters into life and do your thing and enjoy it. That was just,
Even at the dealership, your rap that you did, like, was that scripted?
So that was scripted in the pilot. Yeah. But from that point on, like, I got to kind of ad lib those moments because, you know, they're like, oh, we like this. Okay. And so, like, in the next few episodes, they're like, okay, there's another dealership scene. Guys, you know, give us some smash, you know, and I'll get up there.
Because I don't know if people know how difficult it is to just do something like that. Like, you've got a whole group of people out there.
Yeah. In the moment, it can be a little daunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just about, like, really, like I said, just owning it. And that helps you to be just free with it. Yeah. So
100%.
This is specific, but you were saying that you ran track in high school. And I just wonder what it is like, because obviously I never played football either, but putting pads and a uniform and a helmet on for the first time, did it feel awkward? Or were you like, no, I can live in this. I can do this.
Yeah. At first, honestly, it does feel awkward because when you're used to just like, they're like, okay, we need you to run at top speed. I'm like, oh, I can run if you take some of this stuff.
I know, I'm wearing so many things.
I'm wearing a lot of stuff here. But then over time, you get used to it. And it's funny, because even as I was watching the episode that, you know, I think we're going to talk about, just to kind of prep the conversation, I just remembered like what it was like to be in the locker room. And, you know, every episode had some football element to it. And as the process, you know, as we got further and further along in the seasons, it just felt like everything just gelled more and you just get more comfortable doing it and you know what you're doing. And again, you just step into it more and own it that much more.
Okay. I think one of the things that makes it the most fantastic, you and Liz Michael, who played your mom.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I just watched episode 9 as well. And there's just, it's so lived in your relationship. And it does seem like 17 years of this incredibly maternal mother-son thing. Did that just happen? Did you guys work on it?
I don't know. It was just very organic, very like, it just, boom, it just came together. Like we met, we chatted it up and I don't know, but we just had a connection. I don't even know how to explain it. But then I was watching the episode and I was like, man, how did they find so many of the adult actors that played the parents that look so much like the kids? Like the actress who plays Minka's character's mom, you know, like, I'm like, dang, she really kind of looks like me. Or like, I'm looking at Liz, I'm like, dang, me and Liz kind of do have a resemblance. You know what I mean? So it all just came together.
And Liz is just such a firecracker, man. I mean, even in her first scene, when you're on the couch getting it on with Tyra.
Yeah, getting it in. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But you know what, too? It's like Liz has like just so, I mean, she comes from that steep theater background. Mm-hmm. She's a singer and everything. So it's like when you have that trust there, you're able to ad lib and improvise and go out on a limb with people creatively that is much more difficult to do if you don't have that trust and that rapport. And we were able to build that really early. So that was definitely...
That's such a good word about it. It's trust. And when that happens immediately, it feels so lived in. And I also like, I will never stop speaking about my love for Liz Michael. I've known her since I was like probably 19 or 20.
Yeah.
Oh, she is...
Oh, wow.
She is...
Amazing.
This is something that Stacey had talked about in our pilot episode of our podcast here, that you are one of the few characters, or not few characters, but like you are the most different probably of any of the characters of anybody on the show.
Yeah, compared to like from Gaius to Smash, I find you to be the most different in character. What parts of Smash do you think are you?
All of parts of Smash are me. You know, it's so funny. It's like I get this a lot and I've thought about it a lot and I think the best way to explain it is that Smash is the part of me that I am not allowed to be as a Black man in this world. You know what I'm saying? Like if I let that side of me go, not to get too deep, but I would be a hashtag. You know what I mean? That swagger, that bombast, that arrogance, that like in your face, that, you know, and so I think just culturally, just to be real, it's like as a black man, you have, particularly in this culture, you know, you have to learn how to kind of pick your moments and control your emotions and all that kind of stuff to negotiate your way in this world and in this culture. And so one of the things that was so, I watched the episode, man, like I was on one, you know, I was like, I was going in, you know, but it was very freeing for me personally and creatively because I was allowed to express that kind of power and that kind of, you know, that audacity and that kind of strength without having to worry that I was going to put myself in a compromised or dangerous place.
Oh, I didn't mean to get that deep here.
I do.
But no, thank you so much for sharing that, dude, because that's,
no worries, man.
You know, it's just something that I don't think about.
Yeah. Being that, yeah, no worries, a high schooler with that much confidence. I went to a giant high school in Texas and I don't even know if I can think of any of the guys that were there that had that kind of confidence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also like when you get to go back to high school, like after actually having, like any of us actually having been through high school, you just realize like all your little insecurities or whatever, like it just doesn't matter. Like you just, like you can, you, it's almost like you get another chance to like live out the confidence. You know what I'm saying? So like all the sort of quirks and issues and stuff that we go through in high school, it's like, oh, I can actually sort of get another take at this and really live out my full confidence. So I think that that's something that we can all relate to.
I never got to play a high schooler. So it must have been nice.
So one of the big stories on the show, especially in the beginning, is your kind of antagonistic relationship with Taylor Kitsch, AKA Tim Riggins.
Yeah. Which is so funny because like me and Taylor are so cool. Like I love that dude so much.
It's, I think, ridiculous. That's why it works so much when you guys act like you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Taylor and I used to joke all the time because, would you tell the audience where your bedroom is in Friday Night Lights?
Yeah, it was the Riggins house. Yeah, yeah.
Trumpet, oh, is that true?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. It's true.
Yeah. So we always used to joke. It's like, guys don't get along, and yet he's been staying in our house this time.
Smash has been here for like 5 years in our house. Yeah. I did not know that.
But they actually used two locations because there was another location that they used for the bedroom scene because the actual location where we shot in the house was so small, like it was public housing. It was so small that we had to kind of like restage things in other places. But yeah, one of the locations we used for the bedroom was the Riggins house. That's great. I didn't remember that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Did they ever talk to you about the trajectory of this story and that Smash was going to start with steroid use?
I think I just read the script and found out about it. And it's funny because I remember we had a good rapport with our stunt team and a lot of the guys on our stunt team had played various levels of professional football. And they were like, they're going to have you use steroids? They're like, oh, man, come on. Oh, man. You know, because it's like typically they say, at least what they told me then, is like typically it's not the black athletes that use steroids. Typically, it's usually like white athletes who use steroids, typically speaking. I'm just saying what they told me, y'all. But I actually thought it was like a cool storyline because, again, it showed how far this guy was willing to go to achieve this dream. And yeah, I kind of like turning that stereotype on the head. Like, actually, if you're pushed far enough, it really doesn't matter what the sort of convention is, like this young kid could cross this line, and we kind of saw what happened when he did.
Yeah, that was that whole storyline was just so intense.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that strikes me the most is that I can't remember. I think it was at the start of episode 9, where you're in the church, and Liz has gotten the church to give you money.
The church money. Oh God,
you're taking church money to go do steroids. Come on, Smash. Come on, man.
Yeah, that one is a real, that one really pulls at the heartstrings. That one's really tough. But again, it's like that was the genius of the writing, the acting, the everything. It's just like, just your heart goes out because you see this kid's need, but you also see just how messed up this thing is. And it's, he can't really say that he's doing this thing and he has to put on this front. And it's just like, it's just, it's amazing. It's amazing. Even I, you know, like I said, I watched it and I was like, oh gosh, church money.
You're
Brian, come on, man.
But your expression in that scene, guys, when that offering plate starts going around, I mean, it's like a deer in headlights, but it's brilliant scene because as an audience, you take us there. We are 100% feeling the guilt that Smash is feeling in that moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's one of the things I think this show does so well. There are so many times where characters are doing immoral things,
right.
but with a moral gain. The objective is, look, man, right. you're trying to help your mom. You're trying to make sure that your sisters are taken care of and that your family's taken care of. And this is the best way you know how to do it. So
sure.
we constantly see these characters kind of stumbling along the way. But man, yeah, that one scene just, it always gets me every single time I watch it. And that's a testament to you as an actor.
Oh, thanks. But you know, it's interesting because when I was rewatching it, I was remembering the filming process. Like I remembered when we were doing the vial and the steroids in the car. And I remember, I think it was, who directed that one? Was it Josh?
Episode 9?
Yeah, I think it was either Josh or, I think it was Josh. But yeah, like I just remember like, because they hand you the props like 5 seconds before you roll, right? And I'm just trying to look like I know what I'm doing, you know what I mean? And like, what? They're like, no, hold it like this. No, hold it. No, no. And so, you know, we figure it out and everything. And then, you know,
calling out to some grip. Hey, who's done steroids?
Yeah, anybody here? Anybody done steroids?
Hey, who's juicing over here? Come tell me how to do this. But just seeing how it all cut together and everything, I was like, oh man, this is real right
here. Speaking of, when was the last time, did you watch the show when it was on, or have you done like a rewatch since 15 years ago?
I have not. You know, it's funny, like the episode 9, I haven't seen episode 9 in over 10 years. You know what I'm saying? And what I tell people is just like, just honestly, like when I watch the show, it's often like I'm there again. Mm-hmm. Like I'm feeling all the feelings that I felt again. Like it's intense. So I try not to watch it too much just because it's heavy. We're already in a heavy place. But I am so grateful for all the people who have discovered it for the first time. Even, you know, now I think it's back on Netflix right now. Mm-hmm. And so you have people who are discovering a show that we did 15 years ago that still is somebody said it ages so well.
Yeah. It is timeless. Classic. Okay, this is a very selfish question from my end, but I know that you've done quite a bit of theater, and I'm wondering if it's something that you still would want to do if it came to you.
It's so funny because I've been getting back into Shakespeare. Just I love. Do you like Shakespeare?
I studied classical theater in London. That's what I thought I was going to do.
Oh, awesome. So you know, so you already know. Yeah. Like just over this pandemic, like I've had a lot of downtime like we've all had. And I've been getting just back into Shakespeare, like reading stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, going back to some anthologies. And John Barton from RSC has a great series called Playing Shakespeare. And I've just been watching that. And I was just like, I just love the classics. So I think there is a desire to get back to some of that. I don't know what capacity. We're all kind of seeing what we can do theater-wise. I know Broadway just kind of reopened. I don't know how it's going.
It's a slow open. We're good. We're doing good.
Slow open. Yeah. But at some point, yeah, because I do, you know, the actors that I really respect, like the consummate actors, actresses, like they do it all. Like they do their film, their television shows, and then they'll turn around and do a theater piece. Just like, how are they? Because the thinking is that, oh, well, once you do film and television, like you're just done with theater. But I think the real sort of consummate artists, actors, actresses, they kind of keep that in them because they know it's like the weight training of theater, how much that strengthens those creative muscles.
I say selfishly because I'm desperate to see you on stage. I would love to see you on
stage. Oh, man, you're so kind.
Stacey and I were talking about this earlier. We know that you did a production of Othello a few years back with John Ortiz and Labyrinth Theater Company and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Would you mind talking just a little bit about what that experience was like? I mean, because Philip Seymour Hoffman was my all-time favorite. And
yeah, well, we did the show and the show started off, we sort of put it up in Germany. Mm-hmm. Those guys were just like so just amazing. Like, so they took the show, they put it up in Germany, then they brought it back to New York. And I'll tell you a story. So when they brought the show back to New York, you know, when you're doing equity shows, you have to have a deputy, like a cast member who...
And you were probably the youngest guy in the cast.
The youngest always gets to be. It's
the youngest guy in the cast.
It's a rite of passage.
And but nobody wants to be the deputy.
It's terrible.
You
have to,
like, you know, like nobody wants to be the deputy.
Guys, you get like a tiny bit more in your paycheck, but it's so not worth it because it's terrible work.
And you're like the rep on stage, you know what I mean? Or in the production. And so if there's any issue, the stage manager, whoever it is, has to come to you, and then you have to like deal with it with the cast.
You're basically the liaison between the cast and the union. Like, so you're,
which is Actors Equity is the union for stage actors.
So you have to let the union know if you went overtime in rehearsals. Like, you're the one who has to do
so much paperwork. And you're like, I just want to play my part.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like 20 something. Like, I don't.
They always screw the young guy. Like, yeah.
How did I get to be? But the funny story is, so there was one issue that came up with the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman, who just was so kind, so generous. I mean, every day I watched him work, it was just like masterclass, like just taking notes and just like, just awe-inspiring, just an absolute Olympian on the stage.
Yeah.
But there was this one moment where one thing that we weren't supposed to do was smoke in our dressing rooms, right? And so I think it was the stage manager who came to me like, Gaius, Phil is just having a couple of cigarettes in his dressing room. Can you go and... And I'm like, first of all, right. Like, I'm going to go check him. Like, first of all, he's my boss. Number one, like, he's producing this whole thing. Second of all, he's like one of the greatest actors on earth. Third of all, like, I want him to like me, you know?
Oh, that's brutal.
So I had to go and be like, hey, Phil, you know, the stage manager, it's not me, you know what I'm saying? But they're just saying that. He's like, okay, I got it. Don't worry. I got it. I'm like, oh, thank you. So that was the one story I was like, oh man. But he was always just the kindest, most generous, most gracious person. I mean, you literally would walk past him and not even recognize it was him, because he was just so humble and so kind. Yeah.
I got to see him in a production of True West in New York, him and John C. Reilly, where they would switch parts every night.
Wow.
And that, you know, True West is a part that's kind of written for a guy like me. Like, I could play that with my eyes closed. And I
sure.
I was very familiar with the show, and I got to see him perform it with John C. Reilly. And I remember at intermission coming out with a group of actors and going, I can't do what he's doing.
Nobody can.
And it was, there were like eight of us standing there, and it was, and we were all actors, and it was really demoralizing.
I understand.
I thought of myself as being,
yeah. And it was a part that I know and a part that I can play. And I'm sitting here going, I can't do that.
Just in awe.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because I actually remember him saying, like, he liked the show because he watched the show. He watched Friday Night Live. And I remember him really complimenting Jesse Plemons. He really liked Jesse's character.
I thought you were going to say me in that.
Yeah, it's weird that you didn't say Billy Riggins there.
Yeah, I don't know what he thought about Billy Riggins, but he really liked Jesse Plemons' character. He loved Jesse's work.
I get that too. A lot of people, a lot of critics called Jesse like a younger Philip Seymour Hoffman with his career. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but from what I got from just a quick little combo we had one time in Germany, he was just like, yeah, Jesse. I was like, I think he really liked his work.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, man.
Hey, did you have a favorite moment from Friday Night Lights? Either like an on set moment or a favorite scene?
Oh gosh, there's just so many.
This is literally the toughest question.
I know. I mean, just as you asked, that one thing that stood out to me was the mud. Was it the mud bowl? No, it was wind sprints. Mud bowl was one thing, but wind sprints, like running the wind sprints in the mud.
Wait, how much did you guys really have to run for wind sprints?
We really ran that. You know, that wasn't doubled, you know, because anything that was in pads and stuff, obviously we had doubles. We had to do stunts, insurance, all that kind of stuff, get it done. But anything without pads, we pretty much had to do that stuff. So I remember just running in that mud and just getting all primal.
Oh, and that's the one where you start the Clear Eyes, Full Hearts with the whole team. Oh, so good. So good.
Exactly. Yeah.
We were talking about that the other day, because there's that moment where you've been talking smack. You've done an interview, and that's kind of what sets coach off and leads to the wind sprints. And you're sitting there eating a bowl of cereal in your house, just minding your own business. There's a knock at the door, and it's coach, and your eyes, when you see it's coach, it's like you got like a little dribble of milk coming out. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Such a great moment. Cause it's like, you're like, no, Annie, answer the door. And she's not answering it. And then when she does.
Mm-hmm.
So just to talk more about Smash in general, like, what did you know about your dad? Cause we know in the pilot, you say, I don't talk about that. And then we find out in episode 9, what exactly happened with your father? What did you know going into those episodes? I mean, did you know anything in episode 3 or 4?
I really don't think that I did. I just remember they wanted to differentiate my character from the character in the book and the movie. And so I remember at first, I think one of the early drafts, actually, I think this one in the early draft, I wasn't Smash. I was Bomber. Bomber was the name of the character in the, like, one of the early.
That does. You are Smash. Like, there's no other. I'm so glad it changed.
Thank you. Yeah. But I remember that. And then I remember, I think early on, I think if I'm remembering clearly or correctly, that there was something like with, like, my granddad, like me and my granddad had, or like grandparent were like sort of like, that was the family connection. And then I think again, if I'm remembering correctly, that they changed it to my mom and stuff like that. And then they kind of built out this whole storyline with the father thing, which I think it's so interesting, right? Because for various reasons, that single family story, that absent father story is a very common story, particularly for a lot of Black men, you know, young Black men. And so I thought that was a really spot on direction to go. And yeah, I didn't really know much about it, but we just saw what came down and it worked. We went with it.
Guys, one last question for you, man. What would you say Friday Night Lights means to you in the broadest sense and a personal sense? What was that experience like for you and how have you moved on with, what's your life been like going forward?
It has been one of the greatest moments, experiences, opportunities of my life, period. It's something that put me on the map in terms of my career. It's something like we've talked about that is just classic. It's something that I, and I'm sure just about everybody who's worked on it, is just extremely, extremely proud of. And it's just a tremendous honor to have been able to help tell this story and for it to have so much relevance and resonance in the culture. So yeah, I mean, that's what it means to me. And that's why I even like coming on shows like this and things like this. We've done all kinds of projects over the years, from the ATX TV Festival to Get Out the Vote campaigns to whatever, because it just feels like we have this special community that just lives on because of this amazing work we've all done. So it's an honor, a privilege, and certainly a tremendous blessing.
I don't think I could have said it. I could never have said it that well. That's the universal feeling from all of us, but that's so perfect.
I'm going to steal that.
guys, I just want to thank you so much for coming and playing with us on our little podcast.
Yeah, man. It's always great seeing you, bud. Thank you so much for being on here.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real joy. Thank you.
Guys, that is it for episode 9.
But please join us next time for episode 10 when we'll have another special guest.
This is Catherine Willis. You might know me as Mama Street.
That is right. We've got Catherine Willis, a.k.a. Street's mom, in the house. So until then, clear eyes.
Full hearts.
Can't lose.
Clear Eyes, Full Hearts is a podcast presentation of Cadence 13 in association with Black Barrel Media and Ritual Productions.
Executive producers are Stacey Oristano and Derek Phillips, Chris and Mandy Wimmer for Black Barrel Media, and Steve Walters for Ritual Productions.
Our producer is Miranda Parham.
Send your questions to cleareyesfullheartspod@gmail.com.
Find us on social media. I'm Stacey Oristano on Twitter and Instagram.
And I'm at Derek Phillips on Twitter and _ Derek Phillips on Instagram.
And check out our websites, cleareyesfullheartspod.com, cadence13.com, and blackbarrelmedia.com.
Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week.